This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. Louise Erdrich with Gail Caldwell. Recorded in Santa Fe, February 2, 2005. Native American novelist Louise Erdrich, much admired for her novels and children's books centered in her native North Dakota, here reads a short story, The Plague of Doves, before joining in conversation with her friend Gail Caldwell, the Pulitzer Prize-winning critic of the Boston Globe.
It really is a full house. Thank you all so much for coming. I'm Gail Caldwell. I'm here from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I work for the Boston Globe. And I've flown all this way to introduce my beloved friend and the wonderful writer, Louise Erdrich. Thank you so much for all being here, and thanks to the Lannan Foundation for having us. We're really, really glad to be here tonight. I want to say a few words about Louise, even though it's clear to me from the crowd that many of you know her and her work. I hope that I can enhance her and her novels for those of you who are not familiar with them yet. Louise and I have known each other for almost 20 years. The first time I met her was nearly two decades ago, when I drove to New Hampshire to interview her for a profile for the Boston Globe. It was just after the publication of The Beat Queen. I had read Love Medicine a couple of years earlier, and I marveled with the rest of America over the raw, majestic truth about the lives she captured therein. And I had already encountered a few of her formidable women, the tough, tragic June Cashpaw, who armors herself with whiskey and hard-boiled eggs, and the magnificent Fleur Pillager, who can fell an entire forest with her magic, or walk miles through night and darkness in search of justice. So I suppose I might have guessed that the creator of all that firepower would be quiet and unassuming. But the woman who greeted me that day in her old New England farmhouse was this gracious, elegant woman. And she talked about her characters that day with such humility and so much warmth that it was as though they had just wandered up to her door, like me, and asked for shelter. She took them all in, of course, and that profound generosity is at the heart of Louise Erdrich's work. In the hours we spent together that first afternoon, I remember trying to understand how she did what she did, the ultimate question all of us have for any writer. And I asked her about a particular image in The Beat Queen, when a candle flies through the air, still lit, in the middle of a tornado. I was a young critic, and I was probably a little unnerved by this soft-spoken, fabulously tall woman. And I asked her a long and, I think, rambling question about the symbolism of the candle, about light and shadows. Nice. Thank you so much. Utterly unplanned, but I see somebody's listening. About hope in the midst of chaos, about God in the whirlwind. Louise paused and smiled sort of shyly. And with a modesty that I would come to recognize over the years, she shrugged and said, "It was just a story my grandmother told me." Faulkner, too, called himself a simple storyteller. And like his little county of Yaknapatawpha, Louise Erdrich's Argus, North Dakota, is a place of such humanity and vast emotional dimension that it has become part of the enduring landscape of American fiction. She has given us characters unforgettable in their humor, their earned and sorrowful wisdom, their terrifying treachery. And I am happy to say that we've created and shared dozens of our own stories over the years. It turns out that, as young women, we both had summer jobs weighing trucks. I've also learned from Louise how to survive in a car in a blizzard. All I need, she tells me, is a blanket, a tin pie plate, and a candle. So you see, I think that light of her grandmother's is symbolic. Its heat can save your life. Its flame has lit the way for the great abundance of her fiction. Its love and its irony and moral reckoning. And if she has managed to render the shroud of brutality and sorrow that is part of Native American history. She has also established the sovereignty of its literature in a way that can never be threatened or taken away. It is my privilege and my great, great pleasure tonight to give you Louise Erdrich.
Hey, Dawn.
I love you.
I love you too.
Okay.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out and being here tonight. Thanks to the Lannan Foundation for bringing me here and bringing Gail and for bringing us all together, and also for their work with Indigenous people. It's an incredible what they do with language preservation and education and environmental protection and on is really extraordinary. So I want to acknowledge them. I also want to say a couple words about, well, first I have to say there's a few friends in the audience, Marilyn Mason, Amy Lynn, and Sam English, wonderful fellow Turtle Mountain Chippewa, fantastic, fantastic artist. I'm so proud to be here with you. Thanks. And then I want to say a couple words about my teacher and my friend Gail, my sister, my sibling in the world of literature. I feel like when I'm with Gail, I'm a lot smarter than I really am with Gail. It feels safe, you know. Gail's stuck by me through the low times, and she's been there to celebrate the big times, and she's really the modest one. When she won the Pulitzer Prize, I called her up and said, well, are you dancing on the ceiling or hiding under the table? She was kind of hiding under the table, because that's how she is, you know. But I marvel. We talk on the phone a lot. We don't get a chance to see each other. And I'm always jotting down things that she says so that I can tell her she said them later. Once of an annoyingly dense letter, she said, you need a machete to read it. And she, who works with gorgeous prose, has said of her forthcoming memoir, Strong West Wind, which will be published next February, I'm just working on my little brick doghouse, you know, just working on it, which is, and it's a gorgeous landscape of prose. But although we talk a lot, we've never had a real conversation about origin, history, distance, and the nature of writing itself. I've really been looking forward to this conversation with Gail. And first, though, I'm going to read a story called The Plague of Doves. This is a short story, and it'll be part of a collection of short stories, not sucked into a novel like most of the stories. It's not autobiographical, though it is based on some true events and characters, and those are the doves, the braces, the lynching, the kiss, and a little-known North Dakota pig rustler who was called Mustache Maud. The Plague of Doves. In the year 1896, my great-uncle, one of the first Catholic priests of Aboriginal blood, put the call out to his congregation that they should gather at the Chippewa Mission, St. Gabriel's, wearing scapulars and holding missals. From that place, they would proceed to walk the fields in a long, sweeping row, and with each step, loudly pray away the doves. His human flock had taken up the plow and farmed among Norwegian settlers. But when the birds descended, both Chippewa and white set up great bonfires and tried driving them into nets. The doves ate the wheat seedlings and the rye, and started on the corn. They ate the sprouts of new flowers and the buds of apples and the tough leaves of oak trees and even last year's chaff. The doves were plump and delicious smoked, but one could wring the necks of hundreds or thousands and affect no diminishment of their number. The pole and mud houses of the mixed bloods and the bark huts of the blanket, Chippewa and Cree were crushed by the weight of the birds. They were roasted, burnt, baked in pies, stewed, salted down, clubbed dead with sticks and left to rot. But the dead only fed the living, and each morning when the people woke, it was, too, the scraping and beating of wings, the murmurous susurration, the awful cooing babble, and the sight, to those who still possessed intact windows, of those curious and gentle faces of those creatures. My great-uncle had hastily constructed crisscrossed racks of sticks to protect the glass in what, with grand intent, was called the rectory. In a corner of that one-room cabin, his youngest brother, whom he had saved from a life of excessive freedom, slept on a pallet of fir boughs and a mattress stuffed with grass. This was the softest bed he'd ever lain in, and the boy did not want to leave. But my great-uncle thrust choirboy vestments at him and told him to polish up the candelabra that he would bear in the procession. This boy was to become my grandfather's father, my mushum, and since he lived to be over 100, I actually was present and about 10 years old at the time he told and retold the story of the most momentous day of his life, which began with this attempt to vanquish the plague of doves. He sat on a hard chair between our first television and a small alcove of bookshelves. Mushum would tell us that he could hear the scratching of the doves' feet as they climbed all over the screens of sticks. He dreaded the trip to the outhouse, where many of the birds had gotten mired in the filth beneath the hole and set up a screeching clamor of despair that drew their kind to throw themselves against the hut in rescue attempts. Yet he did not dare relieve himself anywhere else, so through flurries of wings, shuffling, he made his way to the outhouse and completed his necessary actions with his eyes shut. The outhouse drama, always the first in the momentous day, was filled with the sort of detail that my brother and I found interesting. The outhouse, an exotic feature, though we'd used them. The horror of the bird's death by excrement gripped our attention. Mushum was our favorite indoor entertainment next to the television. But our father had removed the television's knobs and hidden them. And although we made constant efforts, we never found the knobs and came to believe he carried them on his person at all times. So we listened to Mushum instead. Our mother had given him a red Folgers coffee can for spitting snooze. He wore a soft green Sears work clothes, a pair of battered boots, and a twill cap even in the house. His eyes shone from slits cut deep into his face. He was hunched and dried out with random wisps of white hair down his ears and neck, and from time to time as he spoke, we glimpsed the murky scraggle of his teeth. Still, such was his conviction in the telling of the story that it wasn't hard at all to imagine him at 12. His big brother put on his vestments, the best he had. As real incense was impossible to obtain, he prepared the censer by stuffing it with dry sage rolled up in balls. Mushum's brother wet a comb and slicked back his hair and his brother's hair. The church was a large cabin just across the yard, and people were gathering there already. Wagons had been pulling up for hours, and now the people were in the church, and the yard was full of parked wagons, each with a dog or two tied in the box to keep the birds and their droppings off the piled hay where the people would sit. The constant movements of the birds made the horses skittish. Many wore blinders and were also calmed by the bouquets of chamomile stuffed in their harnesses. Great Uncle was an imposing man of over 6 feet. His melodious voice carried over the confusion of sounds. The two brothers stood in the center of the line, and with the faithful congregants spread out, they slowly made their way down the hill into the first of the fields. The sun was dull, the day thickly clouded over, the air oppressively still. The clouds of sage smoke hung all around the metal basket on its chain as it swung to each direction. The people advanced quickly. However, in the first field, the doves were packed so thickly on the ground that there was a sudden agitation among the women, who could not move forward without sweeping the birds into their skirts. The birds, in panic, tangled themselves in the cloth. The line halted, and the women erupted into a raging dance, each twirling in her own way, stamping, beating, flapping her skirts. So vehement was their dance that the birds popped into flight, frightening other birds, so that in moments the entire field was a storm of birds that roared and blasted down upon the people, who stood firm with splayed missiles on their heads. The women forsook modesty, knotted their skirts up, held out their rosaries, and moved forward. They began to chant the Hail Mary into the wind of beating wings. Musham, who had been rarely allowed the sight of a woman's lower limbs, took advantage of this and dropped behind. In delight, watching the women's naked brown legs, he lowered his candelabra, which held no candles, but which his brother had given him to protect his face. Instantly, he was struck on the forehead by a bird, hurtled from the sky with such force it seemed to have been flung directly by God's hand to smite and blind him before he carried his sin of appreciation any farther. At this point, Mushin became so agitated that he acted out the smiting and, to our pleasure, threw himself upon the floor. He mimed his collapse, opened his eyes, lifted his head, stared into space, clearly seeing now the vision of the Holy Spirit, which appeared to him not in the form of a white bird, but in the earthly body of a girl. Our family has maintained something of a historical reputation for deathless romantic encounters. Even my father, a sedate seventh grade teacher, was swept through the Second World War by one promising glance from my mother. My oldest cousin Curtis dated the Haskell Indian princess who cut her braids off and gave them to him on the night she died of tuberculosis. He remained a bachelor in her memory until his 50s. Agatha left the convent for a priest. Eugene reformed a small town stripper, and so on. As with my father, these tales of extravagant encounter contrasted with the modesty of the subsequent marriages and occupations of my relatives. We are a tribe of office workers, bank tellers, booksellers, and bureaucrats. The wildest of us, Eugene, owns a restaurant, and the most heroic of us, my father, teaches. Yet this current of drama holds together the generations, I think. And my brother and I listen to Musham not only from suspense, but for instructions on how to behave when our moment of recognition or our romantic trial should arrive. In truth, I thought mine had occurred early, for even as I sat there listening to Musham, my fingers obsessively wrote the name of my beloved up and down my arm. If I wrote his name a million times on my body, I believed he would kiss me. I knew he loved me. He was safe in the knowledge I loved him. But we attended a Roman Catholic grade school in the early 1960s, and boys and girls known to be in love hardly talked to each other and never touched. We spoke through other children eager to deliver messages, and I had copied a series of these secondhand love statements into a tiny leopard print diary. Also, I had written the name of my beloved in blood from a scratched mosquito bite along the inner wall of my closet. His name held for me the sacred resonance of those Old Testament words written in fire by an invisible hand. I could not say his name aloud. I could only write it on my skin with my fingers without cease, until my mother feared I'd gotten lice. I coated my hair with mayonnaise and covered my head with a shower cap and told me to sit in the bathtub, adding water as hot as I could stand until my condition should satisfy her. I locked the bathroom door, controlled the hot water with my toe, and decided to advance my name writing total by several thousand. As I wrote, I found places on myself that changed and warmed in response to the repetition of those letters. And without an idea in the world what I was doing, I gave myself successive alphabetical orgasms. So shocking in their intensity and delicacy that the mayonnaise must surely have melted off my head. I then stopped writing on myself. I believed I'd reached the million mark. I didn't try the same thing again. during that time, we passed Ash Wednesday, and I was reminded that I was made of dust only and would return to dust as soon as life was done with me. The body written everywhere with the holy name, Myron Coppin. Myron Coppin. I can say it now. Was only a temporary surface, fleeting as ice, soon to crumble like a leaf. As always, we entered the Lenten season cautioned by our impermanence and aware that everything we'd given up was only a phantom craving. The hunger of the spirit alone was real. It was my good fortune not to understand that writing my boyfriend's name upon myself had been an impure act. So I felt that I had nothing worse to atone for than my collaboration with my brother's discovery that pliers from the toolbox worked as well as knobs on the television. So we watched the Three Stooges, ours and Musham's favorite show, which my parents thought abominable. And so it was Palm Sunday before my father happened to come home from an errand, rest his hand on the hot surface of the television, and fix us with the fox-like suspicion that his students surely dreaded. The pliers were hidden, and Musham's story resumed. The girl who had become my great-grandmother had fallen behind the other women in the field. Her name was Jeunesse. The trick she found was to walk very slowly so the birds had time to move politely aside. She wore a long white communion dress made of layers of filmy muslin. She'd insisted on wearing this dress, and the aunt who cared for her had become exhausted by her stubbornness and allowed it, but had promised to beat her if she returned with a rip or a stain. Besides modesty, this threat had deterred Jeunesse from joining in that wild dance with a skirt full of birds. But now, attempting to revive the felled candelabra bearer, she perhaps forced their fate in the world by kneeling in a patch of bird slime and sealed it by using her sash to blot away the blood from Musham's forehead. And there she was. Musham paused in his story, his hands open and the hundreds of wrinkles in his face folded into a mask of unsurpassable happiness. There was a picture of her from much later in that era. She was lovely. She had the pale, heavy skin and slanting black eyes of the Métis women, in whose honor a bishop of that diocese wrote a warning to his priests, advising them to pray hard in the presence of half-breed women, and to remember that although their forms were inordinately fair, their hearts were savage and permeable, and the devil came and went in them at will. Of course, June Malaterre was innocent, but sharp of mind. Her last name comes down to us from some French voyageur and describes the cleft furrows of godless rock and barren valleys and striped outcrops that characterize the badlands of North Dakota. To this place, Musham and Jeunesse eventually made their way. "We seen into each other's depth," was how my Musham put it in his gentle old reservation accent. There'd be a moment of silence between us three as the scene played out in our minds. Musham saw what he saw. My brother saw what he saw. And I saw what I saw. Two beings, the boy shaken, frowning, the girl in white kneeling over him with the sash of her dress gracefully clutched in her hand. Most importantly, I imagined their dark mutual gaze. The Holy Spirit hovered between them. Her sash reddened, his blood defied gravity and flowed up her arm. Then her mouth opened. Did they kiss? I couldn't ask Musham. Perhaps she smiled. She hadn't had time to write his name even once upon her body. She didn't know his name. They saw into each other's beings. Names were irrelevant. They ran away together, Musham said, before each had thought to ask what the other was called. And then they both decided not to have names for a while. All that mattered was that they'd escaped, slipped their knots, cut the harnesses that relatives had already tightened. So the two children in white clothes melted into the wall of birds. Their robes were soon to become as dark as the soil. And so they blended into the earth as they made their way along the edges of fields, through open country, to where the farmable land stopped and the ground split open and the beautifully abraded knobs and canyons of the Badlands began. On the Monday that we braided our blessed palms in school, braces were put on my teeth. Unlike now when every other child undergoes some sort of orthodonture, braces were rare. I have to say it is really extraordinary that my parents, in modest circumstances, decided to correct my teeth at all. Our dentist was old-fashioned and believed that to protect the enamel of my front teeth from the wires, he should cap them in gold. So one day I appeared in school with two long, resplendent front teeth and a mouthful of hardware. It hadn't occurred to me that I'd be teased, but somebody whispered, "Easter Bunny." And by noon, boys swirled around me, poking and trying to get me to smile. Suddenly, as if a great wind had blown everyone else off the bare gravel yard, there was Myron Coppin. He shoved me and laughed right into my face. Then the other boys swept him away. I walked off. I stood in a silent bubble, rubbing my collarbone where his hands had pushed, wondering what had happened. Our love was in danger, maybe finished because of golden teeth. Even then it seemed impossible. Because of family history, I rallied myself to the challenge. Included in my romantic tales were episodes of reversals. I had injustice on my side. And besides, when my braces came off, I would be beautiful. Of this I was assured. So, as we were entering the classroom, me in the girls' line, he in the boys', I maneuvered right across from Myron, punched him in the arm hard, and said, "Love me or leave me." And I marched away. My knees were weak, my heart pounded. My act had been wild, unprecedented. Soon everyone heard about it, and my bold soap opera statement brought fame. Power was mine, and it was Holy Week. The statues were shrouded in purple, except for our church's exceptionally graphic Stations of the Cross. Nowadays, if you even see them in churches, the Stations of the Cross are usually carved in tasteful woods or abstracted. But our church's stations were molded of plaster and painted with bloody relish. Eyes rolled to the whites, mouths contorted, limbs flailed. It was all there. The side aisles of the church were wide, and there was plenty of room for school children to kneel on the stone floor and contemplate the hard truths of torture. The most sensitive of the boys and girls wept openly and luxuriantly. The others of us, soaked in guilt or secretly admiring the gore, tried to sit back unobtrusively and spare our kneecaps. At some point, we were allowed into the pews where, during the three holiest hours of the afternoon, with Christ slowly dying underneath his purple cape, we were supposed to maintain the Good Friday silence. During that time, I had decided to begin erasing Myron's name from my body by writing it backwards a million times. Nippon Knorum, Nippon Knorum. I'd only managed 100 when I was thrilled to realize that Myron was trying to catch my eye, a thing that had never happened before. As I've mentioned, our love affair was carried out by intermediaries. That fist in the arm was the first time I'd ever touched him. And that famous line, the first words I'd ever spoken to him. But my fierce punch seemed to have hotwired deep emotions. That he should be so impetuous, so desperate as to seek me directly, I was overcome with a wash of shyness and terror. My breath tugged. Easter Sunday. I am dressed in blue nylon dotted Swiss. The seams prickle, the neck itches, but the overall effect is glorious. At the last moment, I beg to wear my mother's lace mantilla, the one like Jackie Kennedy's. I am splendid, but I am nevertheless completely unprepared for what happens when I return from taking Holy Communion. I'm kneeling at the end of the pew, We're instructed to remain very quiet and allow Christ's presence to diffuse in us, and I am doing my best. But then I see Myron in the line for the communion on my side of the church, which means that returning to his seat farther back, he will pass only inches from me. I can keep my head demurely down, or I can look. The choice dizzies me, but I do look. I hold my gaze steady, and he sees that I am looking at him, and he does not look away from me. And with the host of the resurrection in his mouth, my first love gives to me a burning glare of anguished passion that suddenly ignites the million invisible names. For one whole summer, my great-grandparents lived off a bag of contraband pinto beans. They killed the rattlesnakes that came down to the stream bed to hunt, roasted them, used salt from a little mineral wash to season the meat. They managed to find some berry bushes and to snare a few gophers and rabbits. But the taste of freedom was eclipsed now by their longing for a hot dinner. Though desolate, the Badlands were far from empty. One day, they heard an inhuman shrieking from some bushes deep in a draw where they'd set snares. Upon cautiously investigating, they found that they had snared a pig by one hind leg. While they were debating how to kill it, there appeared on the rise the silhouette of an immense person wearing a wide fedora and seated on a horse. They could have run, but as the rider approached them, they were too amazed to move, or didn't want to, for the light now caught the features of a giant woman dressed in the clothing of a man. Her eyes were small and shrewd, her nose and cheeks pudgy, her lip a narrow curl of flesh. One long braid hung down beside an immense and motherly breast. She wore twill trousers, boots, chaps, and a cowhide belt with silver conchos. Her brown stock horse stopped short, polite and obedient. The woman spat a stream of tobacco juice, then ordered the two of us to stand still while she roped her hog. With swift and expert motion, she tied him to the pommel of her saddle and released his hind leg. "Climb on," she ordered, gesturing to the horse, and when the children did, she grasped the halter and started walking. The rope pig trotted along behind. By the time they reached the ranch, which was miles off, the two had fallen asleep on the back of the companionable horse. There were two little beds in Maud's house, plus a trundle where she herself sometimes slept, snoring like an engine, when she was angry with her husband, the notorious Ott Black. At this place, my Musham and his bride-to-be would live for 6 years until the ranch was broken up and Musham was nearly lynched. In Erling Nikolai Rolfsrud's compendium of memorable women and men from North Dakota, Mustache Maud Black, for that was my grandparents' benefactress, is described as not unwomanly, though she dressed mannishly, smoked, drank, and was a crack shot. These things, my Musham said, were all true, as was the mention of both her kind ways and her habit of casual rustling. Mustache Maud sometimes had a mustache, then sometimes not, when she plucked it out. She kept a neat hen house and a tidy kitchen. She grew very fond of Musham and Juness, taught them to rope, ride, shoot, and make an unbeatably tasty chicken and dumpling stew. Divining their love, she banished Musham to the men's bunkhouse, where he quickly learned all the ways that he could make children with Juness in the future. He practiced in his mind and could hardly wait. But Maud forbade their marriage until both were 17 years old. When that day came, she threw a wedding supper that was talked about for years, featuring several delectably roasted animals that seemed the same size and type as many lost to the dinner guests. It caused a stir But there was only bones left when the wedding was over and Maud had kept the liquor flowing. So most of the surrounding ranchers shrugged it off. But what was not shrugged off, and what was in fact resented, and what fostered an undercurrent of suspicion, was the fact that Maud had thrown a big and elaborate shindig for a couple of Indians, or half-breeds. Didn't matter which. This was western North Dakota before the turn of the last century. And just a few years before, an entire family had been murdered, and three Sioux, or Lakota, had been caught by a mob and hung for maybe doing it, including a boy named Paul Holytrack, who was only 13. So when there was another foul murder of a woman on a farm just to the west, the neighbors disregarded the sudden absence of that woman's husband and thought about the nearest available Indian. "There I was," said Musham. One night, the yard of pounded dirt between the bunkhouse and Maud's kitchen and sleeping quarters, filled with men hoisting torches of flaring pitch. Their howls roused Maud from her bed, and she didn't like that. As a precaution, having heard they would come to get him, Maud hid Musham in the hayloft so he saw it all, he said. "Send him out to us," the men bawled, "or we will take him ourselves." Maud stood in the doorway in her nightgown, her holster belted on, two cock pistols in either hand. She never liked to be woken from a sleep. "I'll shoot the first two of yous that climbs down off his horse," she said, then gestured to the sleepy man beside her, "and Ott Black will plug the next." The men were very drunk and could hardly control their horses. One fell off and Ott shot him in the leg. He started screaming worse than the snared pig. "Which one of you boys is next?" Maud roared. "Send him out." But the yell had less conviction and was punctuated by the shot man's hoarse shrieks. "Send who out?" "That boy." "That Indian?" "He ain't no Indian," said Maud. "He's a Jew from the land of Galilee, one of the lost tribe of Israel." Ott Black nearly choked at his wife's wit. "She's a Bible-reading woman, you damn fool idiots." He took a bead on each of the men in turn. The men laughed nervously and called for the boy. "I was just having fun with you," said Maud. "Fact is, he's Ott Black's true-born son." This threw the men back in their saddles. Ott blinked, then caught on and bellowed, "You men never knowed a woman till you knowed Maud Black." The men fell back into the night and left their fallen would-be lyncher kicking and pleading to God for mercy in the dirt. Maybe Ott's bullet had hit a nerve or a bone, for the man seemed to be in an unnatural amount of pain for just being struck by a bullet. He began to rave and foam at the mouth, so Maud got him drunk, tied him to his saddle, and set out for the doctor's, as she didn't want him treated at her house. On the way, he died from loss of blood. So before dawn, Maud came back, gave to my great-grandparents her two best horses, and told them to ride hard back the way they had come. That's how they ended up on their home reservation, in time to receive their allotments, upon which they farmed using government-issue seed and plows, where they raised their six children, one of whom was my grandfather, and where my parents took us each summer to stay just after the wood ticks had settled down. The story could have been true. For as I've said, there really was a mustache Maud Black with a husband named Ott. Only sometimes Maud was the one to claim Musham as her son in the story, and sometimes she went on to claim that she'd had an affair with Chief Gall. And sometimes Ott Black plugged the man in the gut. But if there was embellishment, it only had to do with facts. St. Gabriel's Church was named for God's messenger, the archangel who serves currently as the patron saint of telecommunications workers. Those doves were surely the passenger pigeons of legend and truth, whose numbers were such that nobody thought they could possibly ever be wiped from the earth. As Musham grew frailer and had trouble getting out of his chair, our parents relaxed their boycott. More often now, our father fixed the magic circles of plastic onto their metal posts and twiddled them until the picture cleared. We sometimes watched the Three Stooges all together. The black-haired one looked a lot like the woman who saved his life, said Musham, nodding and pointing at the set. I remember looking at his gnarled brown finger and imagining it as the hand of a strong young man gripping the plow, or a boy holding the candelabra, which, by the way, my great-grandparents had lugged all the way down to the Badlands, where it had come in handy for killing snakes and gophers. They had given their only possession to Maud as a gesture of their gratitude. She had thrust it back at them on the night they escaped. That tall, five-branched, silver-plated candelabra with the finish worn down to tin in some spots now stood in a place of honor in the center of our dining room table. It held beeswax tapers, which had recently been lighted during Easter dinner. The day after, Easter Monday, in the little alcove on the school playground, I kissed Myron Coppin. Our kiss was hard, passionate, strangely mature. Afterwards, I walked home alone. I walked very slowly. Halfway there, I stopped and stared at a piece of the sidewalk I crossed 1,000 times and knew intimately. There was a crack in it, deep, long, jagged, dark. It was the day when the huge old cottonwood trees shed cotton. The air was filled with falling down, and the gutters were plump with a snow of light. Their heart-shaped leaves ticked and hissed high above me. I'd expected to feel joy, but instead felt a confusion of sorrow, or maybe fear. For it seemed that my life was a hungry story, and I its source, and with this kiss, I had now begun to deliver myself into the word.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
By the way, that was my cell phone that went off. I can't believe it. I think Sean was holding it, my purse, or Christine. It was mine. It's my daughter calling me.
I thought there was someone in labor in the front row. And it turned out to be Louise's cell phone.
Yeah.
Could I possibly ask that the lights be a tiny bit dimmer? Because they're so bright, and I'm staring straight into them. What a beautiful story. Louise was talking in her introduction about the long phone calls that we have. Much of our friendship has been spent on the phone because we live 1,000 miles apart. What she didn't tell you is that often those phone calls will be 2 hours long and about half of it is silence. And I thought, I guess we can't do that tonight, but there have been times that we have sat and read poetry together on the phone silently, which is something only two writers would do and enjoy. And each of us will go, we'll be reading the same poem, and there'll be a pause, and we'll...
There's a lot of gasping.
Yeah. We'll try not to do that tonight. Yeah. I want to ask you the obvious thing, which is about the evolution of this beautiful story. And I'm a little privy to it because we talked about it earlier, but I will go back to what I brought up in my introduction, which is that we all want to know where stories come from, and I would love it if you would tell us the beginnings of this.
Can everybody hear? It seems so intimate up here. It seems as I can't hear the microphone even. You know, this story began with the image of the doves. It was from a little piece in an old newspaper. That part was true. And there's bits and pieces of this story that are true. I'm a collector of historical trivia, and I work out of notebooks so that I have these notebooks full of bits that say, someday you've got to acknowledge Paul Holytrack. That's a real name. That's a real person who was, that's a real thing that happened. And, you know, I don't know how it is that a story suddenly falls into place, but it's as though once I start writing a story, it's very much like, it's not like writing a novel, it's more like writing a poem for me. And this one began with this paragraph about the doves and the priest. And it started, it was almost out of my control, because it had been there so long somehow. I didn't know it was there, but it was there. And it all fit together. And it took about, you know, 2 weeks to write. And I would keep going back with the assurance that the next scene was there. Once a story starts, the next scene is always there. I always have that certainty because it's there for me all of a sudden.
And yet, see, what I find remarkable is that you would have this amazing dichotomy of a plague of doves. I mean, I went dove hunting with my dad, so the idea of there being a plague of doves is so beautiful and rare and mysterious. And yet there's this moment where you have the boy look up and he sees his vision in white, who's a 12-year-old girl. So I love what you said about it's more like a poem than a novel. Is that because of the images?
I think the images collect, and they collect deep inside. And I don't think there's any way to have access to them until the moment is actually upon one. And when that happens, the plague of doves, well, it suggests this overwhelming love, and it suggests the kind of ravishment of love that is very Catholic, mm-hmm. you know, and very much the Stations of the Cross, mm-hmm. the veils, that all of that mystery that pours out, and it's always symbolized by the Holy Spirit, but of course it's the girl that he sees, mm-hmm. not the Holy Spirit, mm-hmm. who comes to him. And the plague of doves, you know, that just, I couldn't get that out of my head, because it also is such a, you know, an astounding, tragic truth to me that we could have had in this country an overwhelming number of animals, of birds, that darkened the skies, that came over people in a cloud, that no one could resist, and that they're gone.
Mm-hmm. So really is the passenger pigeon.
So really, I believe it was. You know, mm-hmm. It said doves, but I could only think that it was passenger pigeons, you know, because doves, they've never been known to cover that amount of territory in those numbers. So at one time, doves and pigeons, passenger pigeons, were pretty much
interchangeable.
Yeah, but you know, when this story appeared in the New Yorker, and the famous or infamous New Yorker fact checkers,
oh God,
they looked through every reference, dove pigeon, and they said, "This doesn't work. I'm sorry, Louise. You probably have to say the plague of pigeons."
No, that changes everything.
I wouldn't do it. No, it's ridiculous.
Well, as you said in the story, the only embellishment was of the facts.
It was
right?
Only embellishing yeah. facts, yeah.
I mean, only a fiction writer would make
exactly.
that distinction.
Yeah.
So I have to continue about your poetry analogy. I said to you earlier today, and I think it's true, if you can go from a clipping like that into this incredible vista of history and Catholicism and romantic encounters, I think that you must think in metaphor and you must not even know it. Is that a fair assessment?
You know, I don't know. You know, if I do or not, but I think that my mind does not work like other people's minds.
I think we could safely assume that.
Gail,
none of
I
us
know,
would be here tonight.
We've talked about the different way. You have a very analytical way of thinking. Gail has been a critic, but also you know, I happen to know she's also very good at math. In my first college course, I was passed by my professor with a note that said, "You'll get a C if you'll never take a math course again in your life." I didn't. I can't think analytically. I think out of correspondences or out of, I guess what you're saying is metaphor.
I think you think your way to another place without even being aware of it, which I find fascinating and brave. And a friend of mine who's a poet, before I came here, we were talking about teaching, which Louise and I are both doing this week, and teaching kids of a certain age and what one has to give them. And this is a woman who does think entirely in images and concrete words. And she said, "You tell them they need to be willing not to know where they're going when they sit down," which I suppose is the bravery that every writer faces. Though I think that is
to never know where you're going.
And I feel that that is so much at the essence of the places that all of your novels take us. And I suppose I wanted a little bit of insight into it.
You know, when the story takes over like this one, I have no fear of it.
Is that true?
I have no fear of it. And I don't know, I'm afraid so much of the time in writing. But when the story offers itself and begins to take over, I have no fear.
What are you afraid of then?
Oh, I'm always, you know, it's, I'm afraid of critics. No.
What a setup.
I know, I'm afraid of. No, I mean, you know, I think we both talked about being from what would be considered on both coasts kind of the backwaters of the country. And I grew up with a tremendous sense of intellectual inferiority. You know, I felt that I had nothing that would ever make anyone would ever read. So I knew I had to do something. I had to, you know, I had to leave. I had to try and be something. I was lonely. I was in love with my family, but I had to leave. But, you know, I'm always afraid of falling on my head. I'm afraid of falling on my face.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know, it's so wonderful you say this, that you were lonely, you were frightened, you had to leave. I think, and you were a failed math student. I mean, is all writing born from some huge discontent of it's the place where, as I said to a friend when I was returning to my little world of the book I was working on, I said, "Back to the world of Gail, where all commas are in my control." So, you know, we become writers so that we get rest control of the narrative.
I think you're right. I think that the discontents and the fears and writing for me is really a way of using some of that to my advantage in a way. Because one of the things that I think I do as a writer is I write a lot about my insecurities, and I put them into other characters, and I let them have them, you know.
It's very
and then
freeing.
I let them triumph. It's great.
And you punish the evildoers, don't you?
Not always.
Well,
not always.
Sometimes,
but those.
Because Louise has said to me a couple of times when I've had close calls in the real world in the last couple of years, she says, one day she said on the phone, "I don't mean to sound callous, but are you taking notes about all this?" And I was completely disheveled, and I grabbed a pencil and started writing everything down. And then later she'll say, "Write this down. You can use him later." So there's nothing that goes by that I've not learned.
It's true. It sounds so cold-blooded, but it gets you through.
Oh, God, it gets you through.
Some awful parts of real life, you know, if you just think, "Oh, my God, I can't believe that this person has done this to me. I am destroyed. I'm destroyed." But what a great subject for it.
And then
the only way.
It's the only way.
Yeah, Yeah.
Of course, then I still remember things like from a novel many years ago that you have, who was the woman that made the jello salad with nails?
Oh, the nuts and bolts.
The nuts and bolts and the jello salad.
Midwest, a very Midwestern jello salad. Yeah, there's some applause back there for the jello salad.
Or Midwestern, I don't know which.
Yeah. What was...
So, I actually want to ask you a little bit about, given the fact that we've decided that in fact, you are not like most people, do we think that a lot of this came from your own family? Or do you think that... Louise and I are both from these fabulously bleak vistas, North Dakota on her part and the panhandle of Texas on mine. And we talk a lot about the land or the predominance of flat horizons. And sometimes she'll call me from the road on the way to Wobbegon and she'll say, I'm just out here driving on the highway thinking about all this space. So I guess I want to ask you if you feel that has informed you beyond the geography of your work, but who you are.
Well, I think it has. I think it has. And I think we internalize landscapes. I believe that. And I believe that it's not just the love of the land that keeps drawing us back to a certain landscape that we were brought up in, but I think it's this sense of emptiness. And there's a kind of power to the landscape in this part of North Dakota where I'm from. It's billiard table flat. It's all sky. And I've always found that the sky, so I grew up on the edge of town, ever-changing. It's a repository for the spirit. I mean, there's something that it's indescribable, but being able to look at or be part of the sky has always been what's, I guess, saved me or brought me back into the real ground of the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yet you had to leave that.
I was bored out of my head.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you said, you know, you love it, and it's so hard, you know. I had to leave, and now I go back. My parents are there. It's a small town. I love the town.
But and it became more beautiful after you were gone, didn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say more beautiful, but I realized, you know, I hadn't left till I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what informs all of the work, is that I grew up in one place, and I see the same people throughout their whole lives and what happens to people. And there's something about character that I think gets ground into you that way. You know, I feel privileged that I've had that experience, that I can go back to Wahpeton and be there again anytime I want.
Does that depth of history inform... I just got through reading Four Souls, which, as many of you will know, is the continuation of the story that begins in Tracks, which is 18 years old, something like that. Read Tracks first and then read Four Souls. There are characters like Fleur Pillager who I have felt as close to as though she were living since I met her almost 20 years ago. Do you think the depth of character you're describing in Wahpeton is what translates into that realness of people like her who change over time?
Well, I'm not sure about that particular character. I think she's the powerful alter ego of a failed human many times. You know, she is very powerful, and my inadequacies, I think, fed into this woman who could do anything. But you know, I meant to go back to something and talk about television, because I didn't really... I think one of the big things about living in a small town in that time was reflected in this story. I just realized I didn't watch television
mm-hmm.
almost at all,
mm-hmm.
which is almost unheard of now. And I think I watched the sky, you know. I didn't watch it. My parents they just didn't have one.
Well, you had to watch The Three Stooges.
No, I wasn't allowed to. I wanted to so bad.
So some of this is autobiographical.
So that is. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, you mentioned the kind of ravaging love, though you may have said ravishing. I wanted to hear it as ravaging, of the Catholic Church. Will you address a little bit, if you can? We don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to ask you this. I feel that there is this profound essence of spirituality in your work, and there is also the dominion of Catholicism throughout, and there's the rub.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that, whether it's about your own upbringing or how you feel like that informs your fiction?
Well, the Catholic Church has such a, especially, of course, people here would know this, like, such a complicated relationship with Native cultures. And in the Turtle Mountain, Turtle Mountains is really so many people. My grandfather was Catholic, but he was also, at the time, he practiced his native religion too. The thing I think about Catholicism is that it is such, because of the denial of the body and the kind of, it's all sublimation. It's all beautiful, gorgeous sublimation, you know. And there's all this racking passion underneath it. And it's, you know, it leads to all kinds of self-torture. It leads to all kinds of self-denial, and it has been both a very destructive force, I think, but also undeniably there has been love, and it's taken me a long time to realize that. I would go and stay with the Benedictine sisters on the reservation, and I would be in the presence of this overwhelming love. And I've never been able to really get to the bottom of that dichotomy. And that's what a lot of the work is about.
Mm-hmm. And yet I think it may be Nana Push who says in Four Souls, I'm thinking of him as he's such a wonderfully grounded jokester in the face of Catholicism. And yet there's this sense in all the spirituality, if you will, of, I don't want to say life everlasting, but the return, the fact that nothing is wasted,
mm-hmm.
that dust unto dust is a fairly universal theme, and that the dust itself is not so much a discarding principle as a ongoing one.
Exactly. I think at heart, all spirituality is about one thing, and it's about our mutual human search. It's about our confusion about our own mortality. And of course, every religion bureaucratizes our vulnerability to the greatness of creation. And so, you know, that's, again, I see the lights are coming down.
No, this is the lighting guy we have to watch out for.
Yeah. Does this mean, so you don't know, there's a clock right here that's like ticking down.
All right, I have a question that's okay. About that blue dotted Swiss. Let's get back to fashion.
Okay. Good.
Louise has four beautiful daughters who I am fortunate enough to love and borrow from time to time. I kept thinking about that when I was reading, as you were reading about the girl and her Easter splendor. I also know that you've been studying Ojibwe for maybe as long as I've known you, but at least the last decade. And when I visited Louise recently, there are these beautiful scrolls of Ojibwe words for your youngest girl and for you, mm-hmm. next to English. And it's wonderful. It's this room's full of, the wall is draped with metaphor in a way. And so I wonder if that is a kind of manifestation of your living in dual cultures and how you feel like that fluency informs you.
Yeah, the language is so, the language began to draw me. And it had for many years, but then when I finally moved to Minneapolis and I was among, there was more teachers in the area. So Ojibwe is in the Guinness Book of World Records as the hardest language to learn. And would have picked that language.
Sorry.
It's impossible. All I have been able to master is vocabulary and a few simple verb forms, and I've been studying it for years. Mm-hmm. There's people who do learn it, but they're rare, and you have to learn when you're little. So I've been trying to work with my kids, you know, as mm-hmm. and my youngest daughter, I've been trying to teach her as much as I can. And the thing about the language, though, is I've started to look upon it as a way of, because the language is a spiritual entity. I mean, it's different in many ways from English, because English, you know, sucked up so many influences. And Ojibwe is itself. And it's changed to some degree in relation to the dominant language, but it still is very much itself. It's very pure. It has a strict system. It's not like English. And it's very low on nouns, because people didn't have a lot of things. You know, not many nouns. The verb forms, each verb has a multitude of forms, and those forms have other forms. The verbs go on like a storm. You can't, you know, can't get to the bottom of them. They're incredible. There is no masculine, feminine gender. Everything is either alive or dead. So it's a world view, and it makes you see the world differently.
Do you ever? That's what I was.
Yeah, it's gonna ask. It's. I think it's seeped in. I think especially, you know, the idea of seeing everything as animate or inanimate has been really part of what's changed my view of things. For instance, stones are animate, and you begin to think of stones as animate. So it's, I don't know how much it gets into the work. Sometimes words are thoughts too, but
the world view is the work.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful description.
Yeah.
Because people say that, and I suspect it's different depending upon the difference of the language, the more different it is from one's first language, the more this would be true, that being fluent in more than one language gives you access to walking into a different world, in a sense, because you think in
it
that
would.
Language.
It would,
so
if
it
I could ever do
the
it.
World view.
Yeah. It would. I'd love to get the jokes. You know, you hear the old people talking, and you just want so bad to get the jokes.
I suspect you get a lot more of the jokes than you let on, given the humor.
People are kind about translating, actually. I don't really get a lot. I think I speak at the level, I thought I spoke at the level of a four-year-old, but now that my daughter's four, I know I don't.
But your daughter's a very special four-year-old. This may be why.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you want to tell us that you haven't?
Well, I think that I'd like to ask you a question. The remaining 0, 0, 0.
We have 0, 0
we
seconds
have 0,
left.
0. And I just wanted to ask you a question that someone asked me. At the Santa Fe Indian School, and it was such, you know what question it is, because it just had never been asked before. This woman said, what was your biggest obstacle? What was
and
your
you
biggest
decided
obstacle?
To ask me that
and
I, at
the last
end of this
minute.
Conversation. Calculus.
Calculus was yours.
I think we're done.
Yeah, I think we're done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you so much.
I guess we can get up.
What a...
You want to get up?
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.